Hello, and welcome to the Untitled Female Driven Podcast. We are three film and television writers who are here to talk about how to make it as professional writers in the entertainment industry. This podcast covers what we wish we'd known when we were getting started, and you can learn the easy way what we learned the hard way. I'm Jess Cho. I mostly write for television.
I'm Erica Schreiber. I mostly write features.
And I'm Hannah Rosner, and I mostly write for television. And today, we are doing something a little differently than we have done before. We are bringing back Liz Caron, the author of Night's Edge. Yay, we love it. One of our favorite books around here. And Liz is back to give us the reel about, you know, what the development process was like on the TV adaptation of Night's Edge. And where things are stand both with the book and with the series, and just give you guys a little peek behind the curtain as to what really goes on in development. Because, you know, we see things in the trades and it's all sparkly and awesome, and it seems like everything is just a go. And, you know, as we probably talk about on this podcast a lot, things are usually not so simple behind the scenes. So let's get behind the scenes. First of all, welcome back, Liz.
Hi, thanks for having me back.
So Liz, you know, I think when we spoke with you last, we were still in the depths, the dog days, the really hot dog days of the strike. How was the rest of your strike? How are you feeling post-strike? Where are you at emotionally, psychologically, physically? How are you feeling about the TV landscape? What's going on?
How am I feeling about the TV landscape?
Probably super optimistic, right? I mean, we all are.
Everything's just coming up roses. I think that I speak for a lot of us who had this idea that when the strike ended, like, we knew that it would take us all a minute to get back up and running, but like, I did not expect it to be the way it is right now. Like, I understood there would be like condensing of the landscape, all that stuff, of course, but this is, you know, not quite what I expected. So I'm really grateful that I have had book writing to focus on during the strike and also in the months since it ended. It's been my sanity and also, you know, an income stream that I desperately need. But books are their own, you know, level of craziness, and all sorts of corporate fuckery can occur in the book world too, but happy to have it. So yeah, I guess the short answer is not great, Bob.
Not great, Bob.
Was there anything in your strike though that like was like a moment that you were like, this was your like strongest moment of the strike, you know, anything, any pickets you went to or any times you just felt like actually good?
Yeah. For sure. I feel like, you know, I talk a lot about like the landscape immediately post being like, ah, what the hell is going on? But like, certainly the gains that we achieved are very important. They are historic. And I feel a lot safer about, I mean, not entirely safe, let's put it that way, but like the prospect of AI being the threat that we felt it was a year ago, we have at least begun addressing those issues. And I have a very strong feeling that if we, and the actors, like if we hadn't all gone on strike this past year, we wouldn't have had a good reason to put those issues about AI at the forefront of the conversation. There just wouldn't have been a spotlight on it. So I'm really glad that we had that opportunity, because now those conversations are being had. For, you know, it's going to still be really hard, but I am so glad it got talked about at the very least, you know, and we do have some protections.
We were hoping you could sort of give us the lay of the land as far as the current status of Night's Edge, the TV series. You know, we talked a lot in our last interview about the book, of course, and we talked a little bit about the TV adaptation. You know, can you walk us through, I guess, what's unfolded over the past year and a half, particularly, you know, kind of maybe bring us up to speed where things were, where things stood right before the strike, and then maybe, you know, where things were coming out of the strike and what changed?
I think that something that needs to always be addressed and writers must remind themselves of, which is something I lost sight of, is the fact that when you're doing development with any kind of studio, streaming network, cable network, like these are corporate entities. Yeah. We sometimes forget, like, because we're the writers and we're just like rolling up our sleeves and, you know, just coming up with ideas. And also I'm just working at home in my little office. Like, I forget that Bob Iger is somewhere in Burbank firing 6,000 people. And unfortunately, oh my God. Like, so I have to say that even though we got, you know, look, we came up with a pilot right before the strike was called. Literally, this script got turned in 24 hours before we called the strike. It was the fifth draft of the show, of the pilot we had written. I had done several drafts on my own, and then there was a woman who did a few drafts with me at the end. And so she and I turned one in that our network, which was Freeform, felt pretty good about. So we were like, all right, is this a version we're going with? We're going with it. And we were just happy that we gave them something that they thought they could work with. It was a very difficult development process because of the way the mandates had been shifting over the past 6 to 8 months at that point. Top of 2023, I kind of got a very jarring wake-up call from the studio where everything that I had previously done on the show, all my outlines and my previous drafts, they wanted to completely move away from. And also wanted to completely move away from me as the writer. And I am so, so, so fortunate that I had incredible reps and an awesome lawyer. And so everything worked out in the end. I stayed with it. I showed up to work every day. And we ended up with a pilot that, looking back, was actually a lot closer to my first draft than a lot of the other things we tried, which is always the case. But the main reason that all of that started occurring, because I had been on this pilot, I had been developing it for about a year at that point, and it was going well. And we had an idea of what the show was collectively. Like, I was very happy that we all seemed on the same page creatively, that we were all trying to make the same thing. And that can happen so rarely. And I was very, you know, heartened by that. But yeah, there was something about when Bob Iger came back January, February, March last year, the mandate completely changed. And they had me make Mia much younger. And then there were a lot of discussions about, you know, the character of the mother, Izzy, who is, you know, kind of this anti-hero, very complicated woman. She's a vampire. They were like pushing really hard to go in a more lighthearted, you know, root for the mom direction with Izzy, which I was like, well, that's not the show.
Did you guys read the book or?
Wow.
The network we were at, which was Freeform, I think that they really were hoping with series like this one and a few others I know they had been developing at the time, were a little bit more adult. They had, you know, just deeper themes, just darker subject matter. They were, you know, they were going for it. And I was excited. I would bring ideas to pitch to them that they were like, yeah, that's really scary. That's really sexy. That's really creepy. Let's, you know, we're into that. And then all of a sudden, it was kind of like, we got to go back to our bread and butter. We got to do teen shows. We got to keep it light on its feet. But we have this really dark, upsetting show. So at that point, the tables turned. And, you know, I played the game. And I feel like I definitely met some incredibly special, hardworking creatives who were great mentors to me. Specifically Jack Schaefer and Leslie Headland, who, you know, were EPs on the project. And specifically, Jack was an unbelievable light in the darkness for me and the best mentor I could have ever asked for. So like she deserves a medal of honor for the phone calls that she took from me during that time. I love her. She's incredible. So, you know, not for nothing, I learned so much from watching them and so much about myself as a writer, but like, holy moly, I was so stressed out during that time. And then the strike happened. And that's
which is not stressful at all.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I had a not totally dissimilar experience developing a show at Freeform because the execs there, I think, are really smart and they really wanted to do things that, you know, could still be in that mandate while still being darker or exploring deeper things. And then my experience was different in that they didn't try to turn my show into the lighthearted Freeform dramedy thing. It was not really, I think, I would say it's not possible. I don't feel like it's possible for yours either. So I guess that's just, they just didn't do that. But like there was someone new came in. It was before Bob Iger came back, but like there was a change in leadership at that. And then they retreated into the safety of that mandate that had worked so well for them in the past. And, you know, it's just interesting to hear you say kind of very similar to what I went through and to know it's probably not just Freeform. It's probably how it goes at a lot of networks of like something changes, people start getting nervous that they have strayed too far from what's safe and have to try to hang on to their jobs, which I can understand. But it is this frustrating feeling of helplessness.
Yeah. Yeah. And the regime changes over at the network and the studio were things I didn't even mention during that time was also when they had mass layoffs and it was really upsetting. And during that time, we actually ended up a new president of the network and the person who was heading up development, drama development at Freeform was also let go. And that was our point person over there. And there were some people at the studio who also had to leave. It was terrible, terrible time. And so that contributed to it as well. It's just like retreating to the safety, as you said, because then everybody's yeah. like, I got to justify my job. Oh boy.
It's also like, I remember pitching to four people on a Zoom. And by the time my project was done there, three of them were gone. One voluntarily, two non-voluntarily, and the only person left, I think, was the most junior person who, like, so it's like there was no one really left who could fight for it the way it was supposed to be.
So. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I wanted to dig in a little bit on sort of the mandate change and their shift in expectations, or at least what they wanted you to deliver, you know, taking it from this sort of you know, more left of center, more a little darker, more adult, the version that's closer to the book and really what probably initially attracted everyone who initially signed on to the project, to then shifting it more into safer, which, you know, really means lighter or at least less scary, less rough around the edges. And what was that process like? Were they, you know, in terms of the nitty gritty of it all, were you sort of left in the dark or were they really more hands-on and saying, make it more like this show that we have that's very successful? Like, did they point to sort of their tentpole properties that were like, this is successful for us now, or this show that worked for us, you know, consistently, like, you know, 5 or 10 years ago and stayed on the air? Like, did they give you sort of reference points or did they just say, you know, make it a little lighter and figure it out.
Yeah, I was in the dark with a blindfold, hands cuffed behind my back, being dropped into a cave. So,
wow,
that
which is only fun some of the time.
I mean, listen, there's a version of that that's extremely fun. Not today. That's I was very like, it was definitely one of those tough situations that you get into so often in development where you're like, all right, they know everything they think they don't want.
Mm-hmm.
But what is it that you do want? And mm-hmm. All they want is for me to keep lobbing balls at them until they can hit one. You know, like it's just really, at a certain point, you're kind of just throwing stuff against the wall. And it's so hard to get the same note every single time. And the note we were getting every single time had to do with like the mother and the daughter like us not feeling like they love each other enough and that they're on the same team. And I'm like, well, the whole show is about how they fall apart. And so we do have to, even though we can have, and I kept inserting more, you know, loving, lighthearted, bantery moments between the two of them, trying really hard to make sure it wasn't like the Gilmore Girls. But right, I also was like,
you also don't want to strip out the conflict, right? Like,
yeah.
Well, yeah, the pilot of your,
then there's no drama.
The pilot of your show has to establish what the conflict of the whole series is going to be. So I'm not going to have a pilot where there's no strong hint of where this show is going emotionally. So that was my issue. So it was just funky in that way. And there were off, you know, there was one day that like made me just want to like bash my head against the wall, which was there was a whole draft that I had done under like the guidance of having gotten notes to do this. There was a draft I did that like amped up the drama in such a way where we like introduced the antagonist much earlier than we intended. And he's very scary and everything got really dark really fast. I didn't mind this draft. I thought it was kind of fun and really strange. And I love that. But they really, really didn't want to go that way. And so we threw that whole draft out. Right before we turned in our final draft to the network, we get on a call with the studio and they are pitching to us to do what we did in that draft.
Whoa.
And my jaw hit the floor. And that was the moment I knew, and I felt good. I felt bad, but I felt vindicated in an emotional sense because I was like, my suspicion that nobody really knew what they wanted has just been confirmed. And I've known this, but now I really know it. So, yeah. Oh
yeah. Sometimes it really can be that blatant, the kind of thing that like if you wrote that into a script, they'd be like, that's too on the nose for the execs to just go back, like to give you this note to like write it the way you actually wrote it before without any indication that they remember that, you know, like it's an exhausting process even when it's going well, you know? And I think, I'm glad you had that moment of clarity where you were like, oh, there's actually nothing I can do that's going to make this work simply because it's not workable. There is no magic goalpost that I can hit, because sometimes that's just the truth. People think they want something, but they don't actually want it, or they can't have it.
Or they have the perspective of like, I'll know it when I see it.
Yes.
My gut just clenched it.
I know, because you're like, will you though?
You won't.
I'm not sure you will.
That's the thing. That's you know, how I felt when I heard that. I was like, well, clearly you won't know it when you see it because you did see it and you didn't
know
it.
Ah!
It was baffling.
I put those people under the category of shoppers. Like they have to see everything on display before they can decide like, oh, I'm going to settle for A, B, C, D. But yeah, it's very, I don't think sometimes that certain people who are in those positions always know the amount of time and effort that has to go into actually making those changes. Like for them, it's an like maybe an hour of their time to read it and give notes. But for you, it is hours, days, weeks of work.
It's so infuriating because it is like you just think back to all those 5 months of marching on being on strike in the hot sun because we were fed up with doing free work. And now like I'm going through this right now on a project where I keep getting, you know, it'll be like, oh, we love this. But at least they're positive. You know, I'll turn something in. They're like, we love this. It's awesome. It's our favorite thing. But just do these quick little notes. And then they give you the notes. And it's like, oh, my God, this is another month of work. And by the way, weekend work or early morning or after work work, because I have to now have a survival job, you know, because so you just look at, I now feel like when I get notes, I'm just, I'm looking at the notes and seeing all those Saturdays that I don't get anymore, but I'm like too deep. You're so close to the finish line, or at least it seems like it, you know, it feels like, Charlie Brown with the football or something. You're just like, okay, this time I'm going to kick it. And then they're like, actually we moved it again.
Yeah. Sometimes sunk cost fallacy doesn't apply to writing assignments because, you know, like sunk cost fallacy, being like, you know, I made dinner plans, but I'd actually enjoy myself more if I stayed home, but I have to go to dinner. It's like, no, you don't. You can stay home. But with this kind of writing assignment, with the amount of work you put in, there's this downside of like losing connections or losing goodwill or, you know, getting fired off your own project. Like the downsides are so slippery and thorny at the same time that there is in that situation no right decision. Good luck to us all.
I will say, in the defense of Disney, the one thing I will ever say is that they did pay on time and they were diligent about that. If I turned in a draft and my agent invoiced, I got paid in less than 2 weeks, sometimes the very week after.
We love that.
And yeah. And so
that's amazing.
I wasn't doing a bunch of free work, and they actually, you know, added a step when I needed to do one more polish. It was my compensation, shockingly, was the one like shining moment of this process, because, you know, they were very upstanding about that. But yeah, the process was definitely Charlie Brown football adjacent. And then, you know, the strike is what really kind of took things in a whole new strange direction, because, and this is like part two, like I said, we turned in what was, I think, the fifth or sixth draft of the pilot day before the strike. And everyone was like, cool, you know what? Maybe we got it. Maybe we found a happy medium. We all feel pretty okay about it. I would give this script a strong B minus, and that's okay. We'll take it. Listen, yeah, I graduated high school with a lot of strong B minuses, and look at me now. It's fine. So then, you know, we were on strike for a long time. So the book came out over the summer in June. So we were on strike when the book was released, and I was doing a lot of press and events, and the book was well received. So it was more visible than it had ever been, which was great. Because we had been working on the pilot for 2 years before the book was even out. So now people actually knew what it was. And we were kind of like getting just like whispers that, you know, because the script had been very well received, they were excited to get back to work on it right after the strike. It was not dead by any means. They were, you know, gonna push it to the top of the to-do list when the strike was over. We were, you know, the minute the strike ended, we kind of like hopped on some Zooms to like regroup and game plan. Like, it felt like in October of last year, I was like feeling that they were raring to go. And then all of a sudden, just crickets for 2 months. No one said anything about what we were doing next. And then I come to find out, yeah, that Freeform had begun just kind of slicing and dicing their scripted development. Not only their scripted development, but like scripted programming that was already on the air. Everything started going away. And that is the result of just, you know, the downsizing of Disney, and just the Disney Plus and the Hulu coming together. All of this stuff they are now doing and restructuring. Yeah, so that was the reason. And so they were waiting and waiting to see if they could still make it, and they couldn't. And then I found that out in November, December of this past year. And then when Freeform officially was like, yeah, we got to step down, we can't do it anymore, like very quickly before the holidays hit, it was shopped to a bunch of different streamers. And the TV landscape has changed dramatically since I sold this show, you know, because we have attachments, we had a script already. I truly can't, like, I actually didn't get any feedback as to like why there was all these passes, but there were, and we weren't able to set it up anywhere else. And so my option lapsed in January, and so now it's in turnaround, but I do still have I retain the rights to both my books. And I'm gonna start over somewhere, and that's okay. But that's how it ended up. No one was buying at the end of last year.
All I can say is that must have been pretty devastating after all that time and all that waiting, you know?
Yeah, I really appreciate you being so clear and so honest. I feel like this is the part of the story that people don't like to tell. And it kind of, the fact that we don't like to tell this part of the story, we don't like to talk about how things end usually with the whimper instead of the bang. And that kind of paints this picture too, that everything's fine and that this part is just like something that we don't talk about. And it's better to talk about it.
Well, it's so interesting that you say that because I've been debating, like, when I got the rights turned back to me. I had people, you know, I have readers of the series, you know, DMing me and asking me, because, you know, a deadline announced the show in April of last year. So there was, you know, people knew it was happening. And so I was still getting readers being like, how's the show going? When is it coming out? Did you cast anyone? Like, and I'm like, well, I can't tell you that. But I really can't tell you that now. And so when I got the rights back, I made, you know, just a decision to say something that was honest, but hopefully classy, and posted it on my Instagram, just so my readers would know what the deal was. It's kind of like, you know, if you go through a breakup or if someone passes away, you kind of just want everyone to know so that no one asks you, like, oh, how's your husband? We're divorced.
Oh, he's
but
still
how
dead.
Are you? Or he's still dead.
I like yours better.
You kind of just want a blanket statement so like people stop asking about it. But I realized I was also just like, is it illegal for me to talk about the fact that it ended? And I'm like, no, it's not illegal. The rights are back to me. So I'm the only one who can speak on this. And then I think the reason I felt hesitant is because I was thinking to myself, nobody really talks about this. Is it because people are just like sad and embarrassed? Because I don't think there's any legal reason I couldn't talk about it.
Yeah. And it seems worth saying that as difficult as this past year has been for you and how you know, devastating this outcome must have been, this is incredibly common for a project to go through this kind of development process, ultimately to be passed on or, you know, have gotten all these attachments and then the studio or network step away. This happens all the time, but you're right. People don't talk about it. I think out of a sense of shame or embarrassment or feeling like, oh, this is going to make me look like a failure. But to talk to any working writer, they've got 12 stories like this. They've got all the people in my writers group. We all commiserate all the time about projects that fell apart. And part of the resilience that you build as a writer is learning how to take it in stride. And that is not to say you shouldn't be sad about it for as long as you need to be, or that you shouldn't down a couple bottles of wine. I've certainly been there. You deal with it how you deal with it. But yeah, it's just, I think that there's a lot of people not talking about it, A, out of fear of like, yeah, bad blood or burning bridges. But it's like, why would that be a bridge burning situation when, again, this happens all the frickin' time, especially to successful writers, not just, you know, people kind of starting out their career.
And Liz, your story is not, it doesn't blame anyone. It's like, this is what happened. To what you said, Hannah, like that people do feel stigma that like my project didn't make it. And like, one, the project cannot make it without you having done anything wrong. You can have done the best job ever and given 110% and it still falls apart. But also like, sometimes we will do things wrong, you know? Sometimes we will miss the mark. Sometimes we will do a draft that we shouldn't have done or whatever. And like, let's normalize that too. People make mistakes, and sometimes that the mistake results in something not going your way, but like whether you were flawless or flawed, like this is what happens. This is normal. And the only way to really fuck it up would be to not keep going with your writing.
I appreciate you saying that.
I feel like that's a good segue to, you know, and I ask this without laying any blame again or saying like, oh, well, what would you have done differently because you did something wrong? Like, that's absolutely not what I'm asking. I just wonder now, having known what you know, having this wisdom and this growth, you know, is there anything you would do differently or maybe change an approach?
The only thing I would do differently is to be a lot kinder to myself. When things started kind of going wrong in January of 23, you know, when I was let go for a few months and asked not to write, that was devastating for me. And I beat myself up and I could not figure out what I had done wrong. I had been working on it for almost 2 years. I had felt like I put everything I had into it, was so professional, put my best foot forward, was never late with deadlines. I was always having new ideas. I never said no to something. I would always just give something a try. I was very nimble and very respectful. And the fact that I was, you know, removed that way took me down so far. And I came to learn, talking to other writers, that this has happened to so many other people on their own shows that they're the creator of for all sorts of reasons. And it doesn't, like you just said, it a lot of the time it doesn't mean you did anything wrong. Now, maybe I did fumble. I really still don't know. But the truth is, the only thing I would change is my own outlook and the way I spoke to myself during that time.
That's a wonderful thing to have taken from the experience. I think we can all agree on that. It's the thing that I think especially high achieving people do and high achieving women do, is if there's something that's out of our control and it goes wrong, we still manage to blame ourselves for it. And taking on Hollywood dysfunction as something that Hollywood dysfunction as something that we can somehow manage is impossible, because Hollywood dysfunction is so obscenely huge.
Been here since long before us, and it'll be here long yes. after.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think like that's why doing this episode has been so interesting and kind of healing in its own way, because I can talk about it in retrospect and just be like, oh, there was so much corporate fuckery going on while I was going through this creative upheaval on the series. Surely those are connected. Because it had been going so well until right then. So, you know, but it's out of my hands. You got to, you know, take it as it comes.
Yeah, I like that you also went to your community to kind of hear these stories from every writer you know, like that everyone's had this experience. I once had just kind of an ugly moment in my career where a project ended and the producer kind of made it out to be my fault. And then it was like months later that I was thinking about it and I was like, that actually doesn't make any sense, right? They could, if it was my fault, they could have just replaced me. Like, I didn't kill a project that was fully funded that they could have done whatever they wanted with. They didn't want to do it anymore and they wanted a reason, they wanted a way out, you know? But like, it took me a while to get there and to process it. And it was hearing stories from other people that made me realize like, oh, wait, I don't need to beat myself up when it is, as Jess said, sometimes our very first instinct. I don't know. I have no idea why women especially are programmed that way. But like somehow I guess it helps you feel less helpless to be like, if it's my fault, then it was in my control. And instead of the truth of it never was in my control for a second, you know.
Patriarchy, Erica. It's patriarchy.
I think it's particularly difficult when it is a project that you created, that you have a sense of control over, if it's your own IP. And so you think you've had control this whole time, and it turns out your control was an illusion. And yet, if you blame yourself, you can still grasp on to that control. And, you know, that's not healthy. Don't do that.
No, it's really not. It's something we're all working on. I think our only other question for you is, what's next for you, like writing wise?
I am very excited that the Night's Edge books, you know, that I have the rights turned back to me, because, you know, right now I just don't think the landscape is great to develop them again for either television or film. But I suspect there will be an opportunity in the next year or two to reapproach it and do it differently, maybe as a feature. I think that could be extremely cool. But, you know, Night's Edge has a sequel called First Light, and it's out on April 23rd.
That's so exciting.
Thank you. So I'm just putting all of my love and all of my energy into promoting that and getting that out there. I'm going on tour in April and May and doing all the silly conventions, and I'm so pumped. And, you know, I loved writing these books, and I especially loved writing the second one. So I'm just happy that people get to experience it with me now, and I get to share it. And I'm writing another book right now that's more of like a grounded sci-fi, but you know, we'll see what that becomes. And I'm just enjoying the process of approaching a new piece of work, because I've been living with the Night's Edge universe and these characters for like 4 years now, and I love them, but I'm ready for some new friends.
That's awesome. I love hearing all of that. And I cannot wait to read the sequel. Like, I just, the first one is so beautiful and atmospheric and sad and angry and all the things I love.
Thank you.
Plus, yeah, you just said my two favorite, or maybe this is three favorite words about your next book, Grounded Sci-Fi. That makes me very excited.
And his ear is like perked up from those feelings. Just like, tell me more.
Let's go.
I'm in that book too.
Yeah. I am, all I can really say is it's sort of like it has to do with alien abductions and whether you believe someone who says they got abducted.
Oh my God. I'm so excited. I just got chills.
They're abducted.
You said my other favorite words. You can tell me. Let's go.
Awesome. Yeah.
Thanks. I'm excited. So hopefully, you know, that'll be finished at some point this year, and I can go out with it to publishers, and we'll see if anyone wants to put it out there, and we'll start this whole circus all over again.
Yay!
Never give up. Never surrender.
Never give up. Never surrender. For sure. I mean, I felt like I was going to surrender, but nah. I can't really do anything else.
Sometimes instead of surrender, you take a nap. Yeah.
Yeah. Don't surrender. Take a nap.
Yeah. I hear that. Well, we are all rooting for you. We're rooting for your next book. We're rooting for the future of Night's Edge and whatever form the adaptation takes. And we're all very excited for First Light, your next book in April of this year, 2024. Liz, thank you so much for coming back on the podcast and for just like being so honest. We really appreciate your candor. We appreciate how just professional and poised you are and articulate. And I think that a lot of our listeners are going to get a lot out of this. And hopefully if you all listening take one thing away, it's, yeah, don't give up and don't let anybody, you know, rain on your parade and try to get you to stop doing what you're great at. This is the Untitled Female Driven Podcast. You can follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @UntitledFemale. You can connect with us there or email us at untitledfemaledrivenpodcast@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you. Tell us what you would like to hear us talk about, any topics, any questions. We love hearing from our listeners. So thank you all for being here. Thank you, Liz. And have a great rest of your day. Bye.
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 Thanks, everyone.